linked to the motive became in some minds such a certainty that when given a clue which could have solved the case, they refused even to consider it. The police were not the only ones to think of drugs. On hearing of the deaths, actor Steve McQueen, longtime friend of Jay Sebring, suggested that the hairstylist's home should be rid of narcotics to protect his family and business. The McQueen did not himself participate in the house cleaning. By the time LAPD got around to searching Sebring's residence, anything embarrassing had been removed. Others developed instant paranoia. No one was sure who the police would question or when. An unidentified film figure told a Life reporter, "Toilets are flushing all over Beverly Hills. The entire Los Angeles sewer system is stoned." Film star, four others dead in blood orgy. Sharon Tate victim in ritual murders. The headlines dominated the front pages of the afternoon papers, became the big news on radio and TV. The bizarre nature of the crime, the number of victims, and their prominence. A beautiful movie star, the heiress to a coffee fortune, her jet-set playboy paramour, an internationally known hairstylist, would combine to make this probably the most publicized murder case in history, excepting only the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Even the staid New York Times, which rarely reports crime on its front page, did so the next day, and many days thereafter. The accounts that day and the next were notable for the unusual amount of detail they contained. So much information had been given out, in fact, that the detectives would have difficulty finding polygraph keys for questioning suspects. In any homicide, it is standard practice to withhold certain information which presumably only the police and the killer, killers, know. If a suspect confesses or agrees to a polygraph examination, these keys can then be used to determine if he is telling the truth. Owing to the many leaks, the detectives assigned to the Tate case, as the press was already calling the murders, could only come up with five. 1. That the knife used was probably a bayonet. 2. That the gun was probably a .22 caliber revolver. 3. The exact dimensions of the rope, as well as the way it was looped and tied. And 4 and 5, that a pair of horn-rimmed glasses and a buck knife had been found. The amount of information unofficially released so bothered LAPD brass that a tight lid was clamped on further disclosures. This didn't please the reporters. Also, lacking hard news, many turned to conjecture and speculation. In the days that followed, a monumental amount of false information was published. It was widely reported, for example, that Sharon Tate's unborn child had been ripped from her womb, that one or both of her breasts had been slashed off, that several of the victims had been sexually mutilated. The towel over Sebring's face became a white hood, KKK, or a black hood, Satanists, depending on which paper or magazine you read. When it came to the man charged with the murders, however, there was a paucity of information. It was presumed initially that the police were maintaining silence to protect Gerritsen's rights. It was also presumed that LAPD had to have a strong case against him, or they wouldn't have arrested him. A Pasadena paper, picking up bits and pieces of information, sought to fill the gap. It stated that when the officers found Gerritsen, he asked, "When are the detectives going to see me?" The implication was obvious. Gerritsen knew what had happened. Gerritsen did ask this, but it was as he was being taken through the gate long after his arrest, and the question was in response to an earlier comment by DeRosa. Quoting unidentified policemen, the paper also noted, "They said the slender youth had a rip in one knee of his pants, and his living quarters in the guest cottage showed signs of a struggle." Damning evidence, unless one were aware that all this happened during, not before, Gerritsen's arrest. During the first few days, a total of 43 officers would visit the crime scene, looking for weapons and other evidence. In searching the loft above the living room, Sergeant Mike McGann found a film can containing a roll of videotape. Sergeant Ed Henderson took it to the police academy, which had screening facilities. The film showed Sharon and Roman Polanski making love. With a certain delicacy, the tape was not booked into evidence, but was returned to the loft where it had been found. One writer would later claim that the police found a vast collection of pornography in the residence, including numerous films and still shots of famous Hollywood stars engaged in various sexual acts. Aside from the above and several unexposed rolls of videotape, the only photographs found anywhere on the property were a set of wedding pictures and a large number of publicity shots of Sharon Tate. The same writer also claimed that a number of black hoods were found in the loft. Apparently, he created them out of the same material as his photos, for nothing even resembling a hood was found. In addition to searching the premises, detectives interviewed neighbors, asking if they had seen any strange people in the area. Ray Austin recalled that 2 or 3 months before, there had been a large party at 10,050 Cielo Drive, the guests arriving in hippie garb. He got the impression, however, that they weren't actually hippies, as most arrived in Rolls-Royces and Cadillacs. Emmett Steele, who had been awakened by the barking of his hunting dogs the previous night, remembered that in recent weeks someone had been racing a dune buggy up and down the hills late at night, but he never got a close look at the driver and passengers. Most of those interviewed, however, claimed they had neither seen nor heard anything out of the ordinary. The detectives were left with far more questions than answers. However, they were hopeful one person could put the puzzle together for them, William Garretson. The detectives downtown were less optimistic. Following his arrest, the 19-year-old had been taken to West Los Angeles jail and interrogated. The officers found his answers stuporous and non-responsive, and were of the opinion that he was under the residual effect of some drug. It was also possible, as Garretson himself claimed, that he had slept little the previous night, just a few hours in the morning, and that he was exhausted and very scared. Shortly after this, Garretson retained the services of attorney Barry Tarlow. A second interview, with Tarlow present, took place at Parker Center, headquarters of the Los Angeles Police Department. As far as the police were concerned, it, too, was unproductive. Garretson claimed that although he lived on the property, he had little contact with the people in the main house. He said that he'd only had one visitor the previous night, a boy named Steve Parent, who showed up about 11:45 and left about a half hour later. Questioned about Parent, Garretson said he didn't know him well. He'd hitched a ride up the canyon with him one night a couple of weeks ago, and on getting out of the car at the gate, had told Steve if he was ever in the neighborhood to drop in. Garretson, who lived by himself in the back house except for the dogs, said he'd extended similar invitations to others. When Steve showed up, he was surprised. No one else ever had. But Steve didn't stay long, leaving after learning that Garretson wasn't interested in buying a clock radio Steve had for sale. The police did not at this time connect Garretson's visitor with the youth in the Rambler, possibly because Garretson had earlier failed to identify him. After conferring with Tarlow, Garretson agreed to take a polygraph examination, and one was scheduled for the following afternoon. 12 hours had passed since the discovery of the bodies. John Doe, 85, remained unidentified. Police Lieutenant Robert Madlock, who had been in charge of the investigation during the several hours before it was assigned to homicide, would later state, "At the time we first found the victim's car at the scene, we were going 14 different directions at once. So many things had to be done, I guess we just didn't have time to follow up on the car registration." All day, Wilfred and Juanita Parent had waited and worried. Their 18-year-old son, Stephen, hadn't come home the previous night. He didn't call, didn't leave word. He'd never done anything like that before, Juanita Parent said. About 8 p.m., aware that his wife was too distraught to cook dinner, Wilfred Parent took her and their three other children to a restaurant. "Maybe when we get back," he told his wife, "Steve will be there." From outside the gate of 10,050 Cielo, it was possible to make out the license number on the white Rambler, ZLR-694. A reporter wrote it down, then ran his own check through the Department of Motor Vehicles, learning that the registered owner was Wilfred E. or Juanita D. Parent, 11214 Bryant Drive, El Monte, California. By the time he arrived in El Monte, a Los Angeles suburb some 25 miles from Cielo Drive, he found no one at home. Questioning the neighbors, he learned that the family did have a boy in his late teens. He also learned the name of the family priest, Father Robert Byrne, of the Church of the Nativity, and called on him. Byrne knew the youth and his family well. Though the priest was sure Steve didn't know any movie stars and that all this was some mistake, he agreed to accompany the reporter to the county morgue. On the way, he talked about Steve. "He was a stereo bug," Father Byrne said. "If you ever wanted to know anything about phonographs or radios, Steve had the answers." Father Byrne held great hopes for his future. In the interim, LAPD discovered the identity of the youth through a print and license check. Shortly after the parents returned home, an El Monte policeman appeared at the door and handed Wilfred Parent a card with a number on it and told him to call it. He left without saying anything else. Parent dialed the number. "County coroner's office," a man answered. Confused, Parent identified himself and explained about the policeman and the card. The call was transferred to a deputy coroner who told him, "Your son has apparently been involved in a shooting." "Is he dead?" Parent asked, stunned. His wife, hearing the question, became hysterical. "We have a body down here," the deputy coroner replied, "and we believe it's your son." He then went on to describe physical characteristics. They matched. Parent hung up the phone and began sobbing. Later, understandably bitter, he'd remark, "All I can say is that it was a hell of a way to tell somebody that their boy was dead." About this same time, Father Byrne viewed the body and made the identification. John Doe, 85, became Stephen Earl Parent, an 18-year-old hi-fi enthusiast from El Monte. It was 5 a.m. before the parents went to bed. "The wife and I finally just put the kids in bed with us, and the five of us just held on to each other and cried until we went to sleep." About 9 that same Saturday night, August 9th, 1969, Lino and Rosemary LaBianca and Suzanne Struthers, Rosemary's 21-year-old daughter by a previous marriage, left Lake Isabella for the long drive back to Los Angeles. The lake, a popular resort area, was some 150 miles from L.A. Suzanne's brother, Frank Struthers Jr., 15, had been vacationing at the lake with a friend, Jim Saffy, whose family had a cabin there. Rosemary and Lino had driven up the previous Tuesday to leave their speedboat for the boys to use, then returned Saturday morning to pick up Frank and the boat. However, the boys were having such a good time, the LaBiancas agreed to let Frank stay over another day, and they were returning now without him, driving their 1968 Green Thunderbird, towing the speedboat on a trailer behind. Lino, the president of a chain of Los Angeles supermarkets, was 44, Italian, and at 220 pounds, somewhat overweight. Rosemary, a trim, attractive brunette of 38, was a former car hop who, after a series of waitress jobs and a bad marriage, had opened her own dress shop, the Boutique Carriage, on North Figueroa in Los Angeles, and made a big success of it. She and Lino had been married since 1959. Because of the boat, they couldn't drive at the speed Lino preferred and fell behind most of the Saturday night freeway traffic that was speeding toward Los Angeles and environs. Like many others that night, they had the radio on and heard the news of the Tate murders. According to Suzanne, it seemed particularly to disturb Rosemary, who a few weeks earlier had told a close friend, "Someone is coming in our house while we're away. Things have been gone through, and the dogs are outside the house when they should be inside." Sunday, August 10th, 1969. About 1 a.m., the LaBiancas dropped Suzanne off at her apartment on Greenwood Place in the Los Feliz district of Los Angeles. Lino and Rosemary lived in the same neighborhood at 3301 Waverly Drive, not far from Griffith Park. The LaBiancas did not immediately return home, but first drove to the corner of Hillhurst and Franklin. John Focianos, who had a newsstand on that corner, recognized the green Thunderbird Plus boat as it pulled into the Standard Station across the street, and while it was making a U-turn that would bring it alongside his stand, he reached for a copy of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, Sunday edition, and a racing form. Lino was a regular customer. To Focianos, the LaBiancas seemed tired from their long trip. Business was slow, and they chatted for a few minutes about Tate, the event of the day. That was the big news. Focianos would recall that Mrs. LaBianca seemed very shaken by the deaths. He had some extra news fillers for the Sunday Los Angeles Times, which featured the murders, and he gave them one without charge. He watched as they drove away. He did not notice the exact time, except that it was sometime between 1 and 2 a.m., probably closer to the latter, as not long after they left the bars closed, and there was a flurry of business. As far as is known, John Focianos was the last person, excluding their killers, to see Rosemary and Lino LaBianca alive. At noon on Sunday, the hall outside the autopsy room on the first floor of the Hall of Justice was packed with reporters and TV cameramen, all awaiting the coroner's announcement. They would have a long wait. Although the autopsies had begun at 9:50 a.m. and a number of deputy coroners had been pressed into service, it would be 3 p.m. before the last autopsy was completed. Dr. R.C. Henry conducted the Folger and Sebring autopsies, Dr. Gaston Herrera those of Frykowski and Parent. Dr. Noguchi supervised and directed all four. In addition, he personally conducted the other autopsy, which began at 11:20 a.m. Sharon Marie Polanski, 10,050 Cielo Drive, female Caucasian, 26 years, 5'3", 135 pounds, blonde hair, hazel eyes. Victim's occupation, actress. Autopsy reports are abrupt documents. Cold, factual, they can indicate how the victims died and give clues as to their last hours, but nowhere in them do their subjects emerge, even briefly, as people. Each report is, in its own way, the sum total of a life, yet there are very few glimpses as to how that life was lived. No likes, dislikes, loves, hates, fears, aspirations, or other human emotions. Just a final, clinical summing up. The body is normally developed. The pancreas is grossly unremarkable. The heart weighs 340 grams and is symmetrical. Yet the victims had lived. Each had a past. Much of Sharon Tate's story sounded like a studio press release. It seemed she had always wanted to be an actress. At age 6 months, she had been Miss Tiny Tot of Dallas. At 16 years, Miss Richland, Washington. Then Miss Autorama. When her father, a career army officer, was assigned to San Pedro, she would hitchhike into nearby Los Angeles, haunting the studios. In addition to her ambition, she had at least one other thing in her favor. She was a very beautiful girl. She acquired an agent who succeeded in getting her a few commercials. Then, in 1963, an audition for the TV series Petticoat Junction. Producer Martin Ransohoff saw the pretty 20-year-old on the set, and according to studio Flackery, told her, "Sweetie, I'm going to make you a star." The star was a long time ascending. Singing, dancing, and acting lessons were interspersed with bit parts, usually wearing a black wig, in the Beverly Hillbillies, Petticoat Junction, and two Ransohoff films, The Americanization of Emily and The Sandpiper. While the latter film, co-starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, was being filmed in Big Sur, Sharon fell in love with the magnificent scenic coastline. Whenever she wanted to escape the Hollywood hassle, she fled there. Scrubbed of makeup, she would check into rustic Deachin's Big Sur Inn, often alone, sometimes with girlfriends, and walk the trails, sun at the beach, and blend in with the regulars at Nepenthe. Many did not know, until after her death, that she was an actress. According to close friends, though Sharon Tate looked the part of the starlet, she didn't live up to at least one portion of that image. She was not promiscuous. Her relationships were few and rarely casual, at least on her part. She seemed attracted to dominant men. While in Hollywood she had a long affair with a French actor. Given to insane rages, he once beat her so badly she had to be taken to the UCLA Medical Center for treatment. LAPD learned of him from Sharon's parents. They also learned from one of Sebring's ex-girlfriends that he had had an argument with the hairstylist a few nights before the murder in one of the Hollywood discotheques. After checking the man's alibi, they cleared him of any possible involvement in the murders. The argument itself was minor. He had interrupted Sebring while he was trying to pick up a girl. Shortly after this, in 1963, J. Sebring spotted Sharon at a studio preview, prevailed upon a friend for an introduction, and after a brief but much publicized courtship, they became lovers, a relationship which lasted until she met Roman Polanski. It was 1965 before Ransohoff decided his protégé was ready for her first featured role in Eye of the Devil, which starred Deborah Carr and David Niven. Listed seventh in the credits, Sharon Tate played a country girl with bewitching powers. She had less than a dozen lines. Her primary role was to look beautiful, which she did. This was to be true of almost all her movies. In the film, Niven became the victim of a hooded cult, which practiced ritual sacrifice. Though set in France, the film was made in London, and it was here, in the summer of 1966, that she met Roman Polanski. Polanski was at this time 33 and already acclaimed as one of Europe's leading directors. He had been born in Paris, his father a Russian Jew, his mother Polish of Russian stock. When Roman was 3, the family moved to Krakow. They were still there in 1940 when the Germans arrived and sealed off the ghetto. With his father's help, Roman managed to escape and lived with family friends until the war ended. Both his parents, however, were sent to concentration camps, his mother dying in Auschwitz. Following the war, he spent 5 years at the Polish National Film Academy at Lodz. As his senior thesis, he wrote and directed Two Men and a Wardrobe, a much-acclaimed surrealistic short. He made several other short films, among them Mammals, in which a Polish friend, Wojciech Frykowski, played a thief. After an extended trip to Paris, Polanski returned to Poland to make Knife in the Water, his first feature-length effort. It won the Critics' Award at the Venice Film Festival, was nominated for an Academy Award, and established Polanski, then only 27, as one of Europe's most promising filmmakers. In 1965, Polanski made his first film in English, Repulsion, starring Catherine Deneuve. Cul-de-sac followed, which won the Best Film Award in the Berlin Film Festival, the Critics' Award in Venice, a Diploma of Merit in Edinburgh, and the Giove Capitaliano Award in Rome. In the news stories following the Tate murders, reporters were quick to note that in Repulsion, Miss Deneuve went mad and murdered 2 men, while in Cul-de-sac, the inhabitants of an isolated castle each meet a bizarre fate until only 1 man is left alive. They also noted Polanski's penchant for violence, without adding that most often in Polanski's films, the violence was less explicit than implied. Roman Polanski's personal life was no less controversial than his films. After his marriage to Polish film star Barbara Lass ended in divorce in 1962, Polanski became known as the Playboy director. A friend would later recall him leafing through his address book, saying, "Who shall I gratify tonight?" Another friend observed that Polanski's immense talent was matched only by his ego. Non-friends, who were numerous, had stronger things to say. One, referring to the fact that Polanski was just over 5 feet tall, called him the original 5-foot pole you wouldn't want to touch anyone with. Whether one was captivated by his gamin-like charm or repelled by his arrogance, he appeared to touch off strong emotions in nearly everyone whom he met. It was not so with Sharon Tate, at least not at first. When Ransohoff introduced Roman and Sharon at a large party, neither was particularly impressed. The introduction was not accidental. On learning that Polanski was considering doing a film spoof of horror movies, Ransohoff had offered to produce it. He wanted Sharon for the female lead. Polanski gave her a screen test and decided she would be acceptable for the part. Polanski wrote, directed, and starred in the film, which eventually appeared as The Fearless Vampire Killers. But Ransohoff did the cutting, much to the displeasure of the Polish director, who disavowed the final print. Though the film was more camp than art, Polanski revealed another phase of his multifaceted talent in his comic portrayal of the bumbling young assistant of a scholarly vampire hunter. Sharon, again, looked pretty and had less than a dozen lines. A victim of the vampire early in the picture, in the last scene she bites her lover, Polanski, creating still another monster. Before the filming was over, and after what was for Polanski a very long courtship, Sharon and Roman became off-screen lovers, too. When Sebring flew to London, Sharon told him the news. If he took it hard, he was careful not to show it, very quickly settling into the role of family friend. There were indications, asides made to a few associates, that Sebring hoped that Sharon would eventually tire of Roman or vice versa, the presumption being that when this happened he intended to be around. Those who claimed that Sebring was still in love with Sharon were guessing. Though Sebring knew hundreds of people, he apparently had few really close friends, and kept his inner feelings very much to himself. But it was a safe guess that although the nature of that love had changed, some deep attachment remained. After the breakup, Sebring was involved with many women, but, as revealed in the LAPD interview sheets, for the most part the relationships were more sexual than emotional, the majority one-night stands. Paramount asked Polanski to do the film version of Ira Levin's novel Rosemary's Baby. The film, in which Mia Farrow played a young girl who had a child by Satan, was completed late in 1967. On January 20th, 1968, to the surprise of many friends to whom Polanski had vowed never again to marry, he and Sharon were wed in a Maud ceremony in London. Rosemary's Baby premiered that June. That same month, the Polanskis rented actress Patty Duke's home at 1600 Summit Ridge Drive in Los Angeles. It was while they were living there that Mrs. Chapman began working for them. In early 1969, they heard that 10,050 Cielo Drive might be vacant. Though they never met in person, Sharon talked to Terry Melcher on the phone several times, making arrangements to take over his unexpired lease. The Polanskis signed a rental agreement on February 12, 1969, at $1,200 a month, and moved in 3 days later. Though Rosemary's Baby was a smash success, Sharon's own career had never quite taken off. She had appeared semi-nude in the March 1967 issue of Playboy. Polanski himself took the photos on the set of The Fearless Vampire Killers. The accompanying article beginning, "This is the year that Sharon Tate happens." But the prediction wasn't fulfilled. Not that year. Though a number of reviewers commented on her striking looks, neither this nor two other films in which she played, Don't Make Waves with Tony Curtis and The Wrecking Crew with Dean Martin, brought her much closer to stardom. Her biggest role came in the 1967 film Valley of the Dolls, in which she played the actress Jennifer, who, on learning that she has breast cancer, takes an overdose of sleeping pills. Not long before her death, Jennifer remarks, "I have no talent. All I have is a body." There were reviewers who felt that adequately summed up Sharon Tate's performance. To be fairer, to date she hadn't been given a single role which gave her a chance to bring out whatever acting ability she may have had. She was not a star, not yet. Her career seemed to hesitate on the edge of a breakthrough, but it could easily have remained stationary or gone the other way. But for the first time in her life, Sharon's ambition had slipped to second place. Her marriage and her pregnancy had become her whole life. According to those closest to her, she seemed oblivious to all else. There were rumors of trouble in her marriage. Several of her female friends told LAPD that she had waited to tell Roman of her pregnancy until after it was too late to abort. If she was concerned that even after marriage Polanski remained the playboy, she hid it. Sharon herself often told a story then current in the movie colony of how Roman was driving through Beverly Hills when, spotting a pretty girl walking ahead of him, he yelled, "Miss, you have a beautiful arse." Only when the girl turned did he recognize his wife. Yet it was obvious that she hoped the baby would bring the marriage closer together. Hollywood is a bitchy town. In interviewing acquaintances of the victims, LAPD would encounter an incredible amount of venom. Interestingly enough, in the dozens of interview sheets, no one who actually knew Sharon Tate said anything bad about her. Very sweet, somewhat naive. These were the words most often used. That Sunday, a Los Angeles Times reporter who had known Sharon described her as an astonishingly beautiful woman with a statuesque figure and a face of great delicacy. But then, he didn't see her as Coroner Noguchi did. Cause of death? Multiple stab wounds of the chest and back, penetrating the heart, lungs, and liver, causing massive hemorrhage. Victim was stabbed 16 times, 5 of which wounds were in and of themselves fatal. J. Sebring, 9860 Eastern Drive, Benedict Canyon, Los Angeles, male Caucasian, 35 years, 5'6", 120 pounds, black hair, brown eyes. Victim was a hairstylist and had a corporation known as Sebring International. Born Thomas John Coomer in Detroit, Michigan, he had changed his name to J. Sebring shortly after arriving in Hollywood, following a 4-year stint as a Navy barber, borrowing the last name from the famous Florida sports car race because he liked the image it projected. In his personal life, as in his work, appearances were all important. He drove an expensive sports car, frequented the inn clubs, even had his Levi jackets custom made. He employed a full-time butler, gave lavish parties, and lived in a jinxed mansion, 9860 Eastern Drive, Benedict Canyon. Once the love nest of actress Jean Harlow and producer Paul Byrne, it was here, in Harlow's bedroom, that Byrne had committed suicide, 2 months after their marriage. According to acquaintances, Sebring had bought the house because of its far-out reputation. It was widely reported that a motion picture studio had flown Sebring to London just to cut George Peppard's hair at a cost of $25,000. While the report was probably as factual as another also current, that he had a black belt in karate, he had taken a few lessons from Bruce Lee, there was no question that he was the leading men's hairstylist in the United States, and that more than any other single individual, he was responsible for the revolution in male hair care. In addition to Peppard, his customers included Frank Sinatra, Paul Newman, Steve McQueen, Peter Lawford, and numerous other motion picture stars, many of whom had promised to invest in his new corporation, Sebring International. While keeping his original salon at 725 North Fairfax in Los Angeles, he planned to open a series of franchised shops and to market a line of men's toiletries bearing his name. The first shop had been opened in San Francisco in May 1969, Abigail Folger and Colonel and Mrs. Paul Tate being among those at the grand opening. On April 9, 1968, Sebring had signed an application for a $500,000 executive protection policy with the Occidental Life Insurance Company of California. A background investigation conducted by the retail credit company estimated his net worth at $100,000, of which $80,000 was the appraised worth of his residence. Sebring Incorporated, the original business, had assets of $150,000, with liabilities of $115,000. The investigators also looked into Sebring's personal life. He had married once in October 1960, he and his wife Cammie, a model, separating in August 1963, their divorce becoming final in March 1965, the couple having had no children. The report also stated that Sebring had never used drugs as a habit. LAPD knew otherwise. They also knew something else the credit company investigators had never discovered. There was a darker side to J. Sebring's nature that surfaced during numerous interviews conducted by the police. As noted in the official report, he was considered a ladies' man and took numerous women to his residence in the Hollywood Hills. He would tie the women up with a small sash cord and, if they agreed, would whip them, after which they would have sexual relations. Rumors of this had long circulated around Hollywood. Now picked up by the press, they became the basis for numerous theories, chief among them that some sort of sadomasochistic orgy had been in progress on the night of August 9, 1969, at 10,050 Cielo Drive. LAPD never seriously considered Sebring's odd sexual habits a possible cause of the murders. None of the girls interviewed, and the number was large, Sebring frequently dating 5 or 6 different girls a week, claimed that Sebring had actually hurt them, though he often asked them to pretend pain. Nor, as far as could be determined, was Sebring involved in group sex. He was too afraid his private quirks would subject him to ridicule. The mundane truth appeared to be that behind the carefully cultivated public image, there was a lonely, troubled man so insecure in his role that even in his sex life he had to revert to fantasy. Cause of death? Exsanguination. Victim literally bled to death. Victim had been stabbed 7 times and shot once, at least 3 of the stab wounds, as well as the gunshot wound, being in and of itself fatal. Abigail Ann Folger, female Caucasian, 25 years, 5'5", 120 pounds, brown hair, hazel eyes, residence since the 1st of April, 10,050 Cielo Drive. Prior to that, she lived at 2774 Woodstock Road. Occupation, heiress to the Folger coffee fortune. Abigail Gibby Folger's coming-out party had been held at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco on December 21, 1961. The Italianette ball was one of the highlights of the social season, the debutante wearing a bright yellow Dior she had purchased in Paris the previous summer. After that, she had attended Radcliffe, graduating with honors, worked for a time as publicity director for the University of California Art Museum in Berkeley, quit that to work in a New York bookstore, then became involved in social work in the ghettos. It was while in New York in early 1968 that Polish novelist Jerzy Kaczynski introduced her to Wojtek Frykowski. They left New York together that August, driving to Los Angeles, where they rented a house at 2774 Woodstock Road, off Mulholland in the Hollywood Hills. Through Frykowski, she met the Polanskis, Sebring, and others in their circle. She was one of the investors in Sebring International. Shortly after arriving in Southern California, she registered as a volunteer social worker for the Los Angeles County Welfare Department and would get up at dawn each day for assignments that took her into Watts, Pacoima, and other ghetto areas. She continued this work until the day before she and Frykowski moved into 10,050 Cielo Drive. Something changed after that. Probably it was a combination of things. She became depressed over how little such work actually accomplished, how big the problems stayed. A lot of social workers go home at night, take a bath, and wash off their day, she told an old San Francisco friend. I can't. The suffering gets under your skin. In May, Black City Councilman Thomas Bradley ran against incumbent Samuel Yordi for mayor of Los Angeles. Bradley's defeat, after a campaign heavy with racial smears, left her disillusioned and bitter. She did not resume her social work. She was also disturbed about the way her affair with Frykowski was going, and with their use of drugs, which had passed the point of experimentation. She talked about all these things with her psychiatrist, Dr. Marvin Flicker. She saw him 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, at 4:30 p.m. She had kept her appointment that Friday. Flicker told the police that he thought Abigail was almost ready to leave Frykowski, that she was attempting to build up enough nerve to go it alone. The police were unable to determine exactly when Folger and Frykowski began to use drugs heavily on a regular basis. It was learned that on their cross-country trip they had stopped in Irving, Texas, staying several days with a big dope dealer well known to local and Dallas police. Dealers were among their regular guests both at the Woodstock house and after they moved to Cielo Drive. William Tennant told police that whenever he visited the latter residence, Abigail always seemed to be in a stupor from narcotics. When her mother last talked to her, about 10 that Friday night, she said Gibby had sounded lucid but a little high. Mrs. Folger, who was not unaware of her daughter's problems, had contributed large amounts of both money and time to the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic to help in their pioneer work in treating drug abuse. The coroners discovered 2.4 milligrams of methylene dioxyamphetamine, MDA, in Abigail Folger's system. That this was a larger amount than was found in Wojtek Frykowski's body, 0.6 milligrams, did not necessarily indicate that she had taken a larger quantity of the drug, but could mean she had taken it at a later time. Effects of the drug vary, depending on the individual and the dosage, but one thing was clear. That night, she was fully aware of what was happening. Victim had been stabbed 28 times. Wojtek Frykowski, male Caucasian, 32 years, 5'10", 165 pounds, blonde hair, blue eyes. Frykowski had been living with Abigail Folger in a common-law relationship. Wojtek, Roman Polanski would later tell reporters, was a man of little talent but immense charm. The two had been friends in Poland, Frykowski's father reputedly having helped finance one of Polanski's early films. Even in Poland, Frykowski had been known as a playboy. According to fellow émigrés, he had once taken on and rendered inoperative two members of the secret police, which may have had something to do with his exit from Poland in 1967. He had married twice and had one son, who had remained behind when he moved to Paris. Both there and later in New York, Polanski had given him money and encouragement, hopeful, but knowing Wojtek well, not too optimistic, that one of his grand plans would come through. None ever quite did. He told people that he was a writer, but no one could recall having read anything he had written. Friends of Abigail Folger told the police that Frykowski had introduced her to drugs so as to keep her under his control. Friends of Wojtek Frykowski said the opposite, that Folger had provided the drugs so as not to lose him. According to the police report, he had no means of support and lived off Folger's fortune. He used cocaine, mescaline, LSD, marijuana, hashish in large amounts. He was an extrovert and gave invitations to almost everyone he met to come visit him at his residence. Narcotic parties were the order of the day. He had fought hard for his life. Victim was shot twice, struck over the head 13 times with a blunt object, and stabbed 51 times. Stephen Earl Parent, male Caucasian, 18 years, 6 feet, 175 pounds, red hair, brown eyes. He had graduated from Arroyo High School in June, dated several girls, but no one in particular, had a full-time job as delivery boy for a plumbing company, plus a part-time job evenings as salesman for a stereo shop, holding down the two jobs so he could save money to attend junior college that September. Victim had one defensive slash wound and had been shot 4 times. During the fluoroscopy examination that preceded the Sebring autopsy, Dr. Noguchi discovered a bullet lodged between Sebring's back and his shirt. 3 more bullets were found during the autopsies, one in Frykowski's body, 2 in Parent's. These, plus the slug and fragments found in Parent's automobile, were turned over to Sergeant William Lee, Firearms and Explosives Unit, SID, for study. Lee concluded that all the bullets had probably been fired from the same gun, and that they were .22 caliber. While the autopsies were in progress, Sergeants Paul Whiteley and Charles Gunther, 2 homicide detectives from the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, approached Sergeant Jess Buckles, one of the Los Angeles Police Department detectives assigned to the Tate homicides, and told him something very curious. On July 31st, they had gone to 964 Old Topanga Road in Malibu to investigate a report of a possible homicide. they had found the body of Gary Hinman, a 34-year-old music teacher. He had been stabbed to death. The curious thing? As in the Tate homicides, a message had been left at the scene. On the wall in the living room, not far from Hinman's body, were the words, "Political Piggy," printed in the victim's own blood. Whiteley also told Buckles that they had arrested a suspect in connection with the murder, one Robert Bobby Beausoleil, a young hippie musician. He had been driving a car that belonged to Hinman. There was blood on his shirt and trousers, and a knife had been found hidden in the tire well of the vehicle. The arrest had occurred on August 6th. Therefore, he had been in custody at the time of the Tate homicides. However, it was possible that he hadn't been the only one involved in the Hinman murder. Beausoleil had been living at Spahn's Ranch, an old movie ranch near the Los Angeles suburb of Chatsworth, with a bunch of other hippies. It was an odd group, their leader, a guy named Charlie, apparently having convinced them that he was Jesus Christ. Buckles, Whiteley would later recall, lost interest when he mentioned hippies. "Nah," he replied, "we know what's behind these murders. They're part of a big dope transaction." Whiteley again emphasized the odd similarities, like mode of death. In both cases, a message had been left, both printed, both in a victim's blood, and in both the letters "pig" appeared. Any one of these things would be highly unusual, but all. The odds against its being a coincidence must be astronomical. Sergeant Buckles, LAPD, told Sergeants Whiteley and Gunther, LASO, "If you don't hear from us in a week or so, that means we're on to something else." A little more than 24 hours after the discovery of the Tate victims, the Los Angeles Police Department was given a lead by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office, which, if followed, could possibly have broken the case. Buckles never did call, nor did he think the information important enough to walk across the autopsy room and mention the conversation to his superior, Lieutenant Robert Helder, who was in charge of the Tate investigation. At Lieutenant Helder's suggestion, Dr. Noguchi withheld specifics when he met with the press. He did not mention the number of wounds, nor did he say anything about two of the victims having ingested drugs. He did again deny the already much repeated reports that there had been sexual molestation and/or mutilation. Neither was true, he stressed. Asked about Sharon's child, he said that Mrs. Polanski was in the 8th month of her pregnancy, that the child was a perfectly formed boy, and that had he been removed by post-mortem cesarean within the first 20 minutes after the mother's death, his life probably could have been saved. But by the time the bodies were discovered, it was too late. Lieutenant Helder also talked to the press that day. Yes, Gerritsen was still in custody. No, he could not comment on the evidence against him, except to say that the police were now investigating his acquaintances. Pressed further, Helder admitted, "There's no solid information that will limit us to a single suspect. It could have been one man. It could have been two. It could have been three." But, he added, "I don't feel that we have a maniac running around." Lieutenant A.H. Burdick began the polygraph examination of William Gerritsen at 4:25 that afternoon at Parker Center. Burdick did not immediately hook up Gerritsen. In accordance with routine, the initial portion of the examination was conversational, the examiner attempting to put the suspect at ease while eliciting as much background information as possible. Though obviously frightened, Gerritsen loosened up a little as he talked. He told Burdick that he was 19, from Ohio, and had been hired by Rudy Altobelli in March, just before Altobelli left for Europe. His job was simple: to look after the guest house and Altobelli's 3 dogs. In return, he had been given a place to stay, $35 a week, and the promise of an airline ticket back to Ohio when Altobelli returned. He had little to do with the people who lived in the main house, Gerritsen claimed. Several of his replies seemed to bear this out. He still referred to Frykowski, for example, as the younger Polanski, while he appeared unfamiliar with Sebring, either by name or description, though he had seen the black Porsche in the driveway on several occasions. Asked to relate his activities prior to the murders, Gerritsen said that on Thursday night an acquaintance had dropped by, accompanied by his girl. They had brought along a six-pack of beer and some pot. Gerritsen was sure it was Thursday night, as the man was married, and he brought her up there several other times, you know, on Thursday, when his wife lets him go out. Question: did they use your pad? Answer: yes, they did, and I drank some beer while they made out. Gerritsen recalled that he drank four beers, smoked two joints, took one dexedrine, and was sick all day Friday. About 8:30 or 9 p.m. Friday, Gerritsen said, he went down to the Sunset Strip to buy a pack of cigarettes and a TV dinner. He guessed the time of his return at about 10, but couldn't be sure, not having a watch. As he passed the main house, he noticed the lights were on, but he didn't see anyone, nor did he observe anything out of the ordinary. Then, about a quarter of 12 or something like that, Steve Parent came up and, you know, he brought his radio with him. He had a radio, clock radio, and I didn't expect him or anything, and he asked me how I'd been and everything. Parent plugged in the radio to demonstrate how it worked, but Gerritsen wasn't interested. Then I gave him a beer, and he drank it, and then he called somebody. Somebody on Santa Monica and Doheny, and he said that he would be going there, and so then he left, and, you know, that's the last time I saw him. When found in Parent's car, the clock radio had stopped at 12:15 a.m., the approximate time of the murder. Although it could have been a remarkable coincidence, the logical presumption was that Parent had set it while demonstrating it to Gerritsen, then unplugged it just before he left. This would coincide with Gerritsen's estimate of the time. According to Gerritsen, after Parent left, he wrote some letters and played the stereo, not going to sleep until just before dawn. Though he claimed to have heard nothing unusual during the night, he admitted that he had been scared. "Why?" Burdick asked. "Well," Gerritsen replied, "not long after Steve left, he noticed that the handle of the door was turned down, as if someone had tried to open it. And when he tried to use the phone to learn the time, he found it was dead." Like the other officers, Burdick found it difficult to believe that Gerritsen, though admittedly awake all night, heard nothing, while neighbors even farther away heard shots or screams. Gerritsen insisted, however, that he had neither heard nor seen anything. He was less sure on another point, whether he had gone out into the backyard when he let out the Belly's dogs out. To Burdick, he appeared evasive about this. From the yard, however, he couldn't see the main house, though he might have heard something. As far as LAPD was concerned, the moment of truth was now arriving. Burdick began setting up the polygraph, at the same time reading Gerritsen the list of questions he intended to ask. This, too, was standard operating procedure, and more than a little psychological. Knowing a certain question was going to be asked, but not when, built tension, accentuating the response. He then began the test. Question: is your true last name Gerritsen? Answer: yes. No significant response. Question: concerning Steve, did you cause his death? Answer: no. Facing forward, Gerritsen couldn't see Burdick's face. Burdick kept his voice matter-of-fact as he moved on to the next question, in no way indicating that the steel pens had jerked across the graph. Question: you understand the questions? Answer: yes. Question: do you feel responsible for Steve's death? Answer: that he even knew me, yes. Question: huh? Answer: that he even knew me. I mean, he wouldn't have come up that night, and nothing would have happened, in other words, to him. Burdick relieved the pressure cup on Gerritsen's arm, told him to relax, talked to him informally for a while. Then again, the pressure and the questions, only slightly changed this time. Question. Is your true last name Gerritsen? Answer. Yes. Question. Did you shoot Steve? Answer. No. No significant response. More test questions, followed by, do you know who caused Mrs. Polanski's death? Answer. No. Question. Did you cause Mrs. Polanski's death? Answer. No. Still, no significant response. Burdick now accepted Gerritsen's explanation that he felt responsibility for Perrin's death, but had no part in causing it or the other murders. The examination went on for another half hour or so, during which Burdick closed off several avenues of investigation. Gerritsen was not gay. He had never had sex with any of the victims. He had never sold drugs. There was no indication that Gerritsen was lying, but he remained nervous throughout. Burdick asked him why. Gerritsen explained that when he was being taken to his cell, a policeman had pointed at him, saying, "There's the guy that killed all those people." Question. I would imagine it would shake you up. But that doesn't mean you're lying. Answer. No, I'm just confused. Question. Why are you confused? Answer. For one thing, how come I wasn't murdered? Question. I don't know. Although legally inadmissible as evidence, the police believe in the polygraph. In 1972, a Los Angeles Superior Court judge broke with precedent and permitted the results of a polygraph test to be received into evidence in a marijuana case. Though uninformed of it at the time, Gerritsen had passed. At the conclusion of the examination, Captain Don Martin, Commander SID, wrote in his official report, "It was the examiner's opinion that Mr. Gerritsen was truthful and not criminally involved in the Polanski homicides." Unofficially, though Burdick believed Gerritsen clean on participation, he felt he was a little muddy on knowledge. It was possible that he had heard something, then fearful, hidden until dawn. This was just conjecture, however. For all intents and purposes, with the polygraph, William Esten Gerritsen ceased to be a good suspect. Yet that bothersome question remained. Every single human being at 10,050 Cielo Drive had been slaughtered, save one. Why? Because there was no immediate answer, and certainly in part because, having been the only warm body on the premises, he had seemed such a likely suspect, Gerritsen was held for another day. That same Sunday, Gerald D. Friedman, a UCLA student, contacted the police and informed them that the call Stephen Parent made at approximately 11:45 on Friday night had been to him. Parent was going to build a stereo set for Friedman, and he wanted to talk over the details. Friedman had tried to beg off, saying it was late, but finally gave in and told Parent he could drop by for a few minutes. Parent had asked him the time, and when he told him, said he would be there about 12:30. It was possible when Parent asked the time, he also set the radio clock. According to Friedman, he never got there. That Sunday, LAPD not only lost their best suspect to date, another promising lead fizzled out. Sharon Tate's red Ferrari, which the police had thought might have been used as a getaway car, was located in a Beverly Hills garage where Sharon had taken it the previous week for repairs. That evening, Roman Polanski returned from London. Reporters who saw him at the airport described him as terribly crushed and beaten by the tragedy. Though he refused to talk with the press, a spokesman for him denied there was any truth to the rumors of a marital rift. Polanski had remained in London, he said, because he hadn't finished his work there. Sharon had returned home early by boat because of airline restrictions against travel during the last 2 months of pregnancy. Polanski was taken to an apartment inside the Paramount lot, where he remained in seclusion under a doctor's care. The police talked to him briefly that night, but he was at that time unable to suggest anyone with a motive for the murders. Frank Struthers also returned to Los Angeles that Sunday night. About 8:30 p.m., the Safis dropped him off at the end of the long driveway leading to the LaBianca residence. Lugging his suitcase and camping equipment up the driveway, the 15-year-old noticed that the speedboat was still on the trailer behind Lino's Thunderbird. That seemed odd. His stepfather didn't like to leave the boat out overnight. Stowing his equipment in the garage, he went to the back door of the residence. Only then did he notice that all the window shades had been